It is 7:31 time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Bud Welch. Bud Welch lost his daughter in 1995 in the Oklahoma City bombing. In his journey since that time, he has become an outspoken opponent of the death penalty. His writings have appeared in major publications, and he has addressed numerous elected bodies, including the U.S. Congress, the British and European Union, and the Russian Duma. He is on the board of the National Coalition Against the Death Penalty and also on the board of the Oklahoma City National Memorial Foundation. And he is president of Murder Victims Families for Human Rights. Bud, thank you very much for spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Mike. I'm happy to be back here in Seattle. I was here about 8 years ago and spent several days speaking various places in the area. And as a matter of fact, I think you and I met at that time.
Start out, if you would. Your journey really starts on April 19th, 1995. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, on the morning of, on the Wednesday morning, April the 19th, my only daughter, Julie, had gone to work at 8 o'clock and had an appointment with a Mexican man that could not speak English at 9. She was Spanish translator for the Social Security Administration. And Julie had left the rear of the Murrah building on the first floor, her office, and walked forward to the Social Security waiting room to get her client, who had been brought there by a friend of his. And Julie and the two men were returning to her office and got about halfway through the building when the bomb went off at 9:02. And actually, all of my life, I had always been opposed to the death penalty. I just thought it was something we should not be doing. My parents were opposed to it. I recall that my grandparents also were opposed to the death penalty. And I had often been warned by friends or acquaintances that if it ever happened to me, that I would have a loved one murdered, especially when Julie became a teenager, that I'd change my mind about the death penalty. And actually, after Julie's death, I indeed did that. The first month after her death, I frankly didn't even want a trial for Tim McVeigh or Terry Nichols. I simply wanted them fried, and I thought the legal system was just a waste of time. I finally accepted the fact after about a month that we had to have trials to hopefully learn the truth. I still struggled with the death penalty for another 10 months or so, and I spent 37 years running Texaco service stations in Oklahoma City. I retired from that 4 years ago, and I'd close my Texaco station at night, and the first thing I would do when I'd arrive at home is I'd make a drink. And if I drank enough, when I went to bed, I could go to sleep. It was the next day that I was paying for it. So this self-medication was going on and kept escalating. The hangovers lasted till mid-morning, then midday, and probably about the last month of that horrible period of my life, they lasted all day long. And I remember going to the bomb site each day after Julie's death. I felt a special closeness by going there. In fact, we were to meet for lunch at 11:30 that Wednesday. We tried to meet each Wednesday for lunch. And I remember standing across the street and where the Murrah building had once stood. All the rubble had been cleaned up. This is almost 10 months after the bombing. And a chain-link fence had surrounded the footprint of the building. And people actually hung thousands of items on this chain-link fence. Thousands of people walked that chain link fence every day the first year after the bombing. And it's 3 in the afternoon, a cold day, about the last day of January of 96, and my head was splitting from abusing alcohol the night before. And I went to asking myself a series of questions. What did I need to do to move forward? Because what I was doing was not working. And there were three questions that stuck in my mind, and that is, do you need trials to begin now? The first trial did not start for 25 months. Do you need convictions, and do you need executions? And struggling with those three questions mainly on my mind for about 20 or 25 days, I came to the conclusion that the day that we would take Tim McVeigh or Terry Nichols from their cages to kill them would be an act of revenge and hate. And revenge and hate was the very reason that Julie and 167 others are dead in that great city today. It was the revenge and hate that Tim McVeigh and Terry Nichols had against the U.S. government for what had happened at Waco, Texas, April the 19th, 1993. The Murrah building bombing was the second anniversary of Waco. And after being able to understand what it really, what pushed them off the table, so to speak, not justifying, of course, what they did, but understanding what they did with their vengeance, I knew then that I had to redirect mine some other way. And I was able, once I understood clearly what had taken place, I started remembering things that I had suppressed that happened shortly after the bombing. And one incident was about 3 weeks after the bombing, during the time I did not want a trial for Tim McVeigh. There was a soundbite on the news that Bill McVeigh, his father, was going to be on television after this series of commercials. And I remember my thought then was, I don't want to see this. I just don't want to see it. And however, I didn't change the channel, didn't leave the room. And I sat and watched as Bill was being interviewed. He lives in a rural area about 20 miles from Buffalo, New York. And he was standing in front of his house, stooped over a flower bed like maybe he was nervously pulling weeds. And there was a television camera to his right shoulder. The reporter would ask a question and kind of hold the microphone down where Bill could answer. And I don't recall any questions that reporter asked him that day or any answers that Bill gave. But on his final answer, he stood almost straight up, still stooped. I didn't know at that moment that he had back problems. And he looked to his right into the lens of the television camera for just a couple of seconds. And when he did, I could see this large man, physically stooped. He's about 6'3", physically stooped, in pain, and he had a grief in his eyes. You could see that. You could see the pain in his eyes, and I recognized that immediately because I was living that same pain. But I knew, however, even though my emotions were what they were that day, that someday I wanted to go tell that man that I truly cared how he felt and did not blame him or his family for what his son had done. Well, more than 3 years passed, and I had the chance to do that. I received a phone call from a nun from Attica Prison who does minister work there. In fact, she still does it to this day. And this was 38 months after the bombing. This is June of 1998. And she requested that I come to Buffalo, Niagara Falls area of western New York to speak against the death penalty. I'd been doing that for about a year and a half at that point. And in fact, that was about 5 months after coming to Seattle for my first time speaking. And I agreed to go the first week of September, and I told her the story of seeing Bill McVeigh more than 3 years earlier on television and how I often thought of his well-being, and she convinced me that a meeting should be arranged between the two of us, or at least attempt that. And I agreed to that, and it took her about 6 weeks to arrange the meeting. And I went in September and met with him on a Saturday morning at his home, and found him to be just another father like myself. And one thing that Bill McVeigh and I both have in common is that we have both buried children. And I often say that when your parents die, you go to the hilltop and you bury them. When your children die, you bury them in your heart. And it's forever. It never goes away. And even though Tim McVeigh killed my daughter, his father still had to bury his son.
And what was the motive in speaking out as publicly as you have? I mean, a lot of people could have, you know, at least gone through the changes you did quietly.
Well, I had the, because of my opposition to the death penalty, and because the enormity of the Oklahoma City bombing, I had the opportunity to travel a lot and speak. And I know that there are many people, many victims' family members that have had loved ones that have been murdered, and children murdered as well. And I say that they're not lucky like I am. I know that that I have the chance to travel and speak, not because who Bud Welch is, and not because who Julie Welch was, because of the enormity of the Oklahoma City bombing. And I have this feeling in my heart that I want the whole world to know who my kid was. And I say I'm lucky, and the reason I say that is because I have the chance to tell hundreds of thousands of people who my kid was. And it will be 11 years this April, and I really feel like that I still kind of keep Julie alive. I want to honor what her wishes were. Julie was strongly opposed to the death penalty. She formed the Amnesty International chapter at Bishop McGinnis High School in Oklahoma City at the age of 16, and that was in 1987. That chapter is still active today. And she would go out and hold a sign in front of the governor's mansion if there was an execution taking place. And I never demonstrated like that as long as she was alive. And it was almost like that Julie had this little white flag that she carried. And she wasn't a very big young woman. She was 23 years old when she was killed. And she was 5'1" tall and weighed about 103 pounds. And she no longer can carry that little white flag, and I'm committed to carrying it until the day I die. That's just my mission.
So what are the reasons for your opposing the death penalty?
I see no gain for normal human beings to see another human take their last breath. I think it's just awful in this country that we have the death penalty. We're in bed with China, I often say, does the death penalty right. They shoot them in the back of the head and they sell the organs. They make a profit off of it. We do it differently, but we still kill people. And Saudi Arabia, Iran, that's the countries that we're keeping company with. There's no death penalty left in Europe, none of the European countries, nor Canada, nor Mexico. If someone commits a murder here in Seattle and they make it to Canada, the state of Washington can't even get that prisoner back, that accused person back, until Washington has guaranteed the state of the country of Canada that they will not seek the death penalty. And that's true of all the European countries. As a matter of fact, the European Union has within their constitution that no member state can turn a human being over to any country that they're seeking the death penalty. They just can't do it. And I think it's something that we need to finally come into the 21st century in this country and abolish it. I know that we're slow with a lot of social things. We like to think of ourselves as maybe social leaders or leaders in human rights, and we're frankly not. We're followers. 150 years ago when it came to slavery, many European countries, or most all European countries, had abolished slavery, and we struggled with it until 150 years ago. In fact, we struggled with it for many years after that. And we had other issues that we were late on doing, giving the women the right to vote, for example, 90 years ago, people in European countries, women in European countries, had the right to vote. Even dealing with something that I lived through in the 50s and the 60s, and that's desegregation. And, of course, on all of these issues, we had the one group of people that would always show you in Scripture why slavery was okay, why women should not have the right to vote, why the races should be segregated. And we have the same thing today in people picking up Scripture and saying why we should have the death penalty. And I think we need to come to our senses and abolish it, because as Julie told me one time driving back from Milwaukee, she had gone to college at Marquette University in Milwaukee, had won a foreign language scholarship there. And I had WBBM radio on out of Chicago. It's an all-news radio station. They had told of an execution that had happened the night before in Texas. And Julie's response to that, she was about 20 at the time, her response to that was, "Dad, all they're doing down in Texas is teaching hate to their children, and it has no social redeeming value." And I didn't think a great lot of that statement when she made it that time, but then after Julie was killed 3 years later, that still echoes in my mind every single day, and it is so true.
What's your response to the people that say by using the death penalty that will bring closure to the victims' families?
You know, Mike, I've heard that old closure, that old media word closure, thousands of times, and I'll give you a good example of that. I was testifying in Carson City, Nevada, 4 years ago. The Nevada legislature meets every other year, but their committees meet on the odd years. And I was sitting in this hearing room. It was a joint session between the Senate and House Judiciary Committees. And there was a remote on from Clark County, Las Vegas, and the top assistant district attorney was on for several hours. And he kept, and of course, the issue was a 2-year moratorium on the death penalty in Nevada. And he said, he kept saying that Nevada had to have the death penalty, and he needed to be able to have that tool to be able to bring closure to the victim's family members. And after hearing him say that a number of times over a period of about an hour and a half, I knew basically what the figures were nationwide on the death penalty. And there's a young staff attorney sitting there, and I asked him, I said, can you go get the facts on the state of Nevada on murders and how many of those people are actually put on death row? So he was gone about 45 minutes and came back. And sure enough, it was much like the rest of the country. For every 100 murders, or one of them, he ends up on death row, basically. And so when I finally had a chance to make my remarks, I asked the chair lady, I said, can I ask some questions of the district attorney in Clark County? And she said, of course. And when I made the statement to him that I understand that you think that you need the death penalty to bring closure to the victim's family members, then why are you only bringing closure to 1% of the victim's family members? That's all you're putting on death row. What are you doing for the other 99% of the rest of us? Well, his first reaction was to argue the figures. He frankly did not know. I did know because I had firsthand information right from the Capitol there. And after he accepted the fact that may be the figures, he really had no way of responding to it because he had built his case all morning long on bringing closure to victims' family members. And here he'd found out that he was only helping 1% of them. So that's... And that 1%, I might add, is very typically across the country is the easy ones. And by easy, I mean the poor ones. You don't have any O.J. Simpsons on death row at Walla Walla. We don't have any O.J. Simpsons on death row at McAllister or Huntsville or Florence, Arizona or San Quentin. So if you have the money, you don't end up on death row. In fact, many times you don't even end up convicted. But if you're poor, death row is for you. We used to be very prejudiced about putting the blacks and people of color on death row. But nowadays, we'll even kill the white guy. The only key is he has to be poor.
There are some critics who have said that the whole act of murdering those who have committed these crimes is really an event in itself, as like it's a political event.
Yeah, we had a huge staged political event. I want to repeat that. A huge staged political event that occurred in this country. It was a Monday morning at 7 a.m., June the 11th, 2001, in Terre Haute, Indiana. We took Tim McVeigh from his cage and we killed him. And there was nothing about that process that brought me any peace or any feel good. And as mentioned, I'm on the board of directors of the Oklahoma City National Memorial. I've been on the board since the beginning, more than 10 years. And I know most of the family members. And I know that about half of the family members were looking for relief that Monday morning. And they simply did not receive it. I've had any number that have come to me since, and the most common thing they will say is, well, it didn't do for me what I thought it would. And we're told by prosecution that the death penalty will bring us closure. It'll make us feel better. And you know, it actually works in the opposite for a number of people. And I know some people in Oklahoma City that feel worse about the fact that Tim McVeigh is now dead. One lady had said to me, in fact, she's corresponding with Terry Nichols now, and she's getting some healing from that. She's not the only one corresponding with him. There are several that are. But she said to me, it was on April the 19th of this last year, the 10th anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing. I asked her, she had spent most of that time really not speaking to me because she was for the death penalty for Tim McVeigh, and prior to his death, we were very good friends, spoke a lot at committee meetings or whatever we were having. And after his death, she learned that what I had been saying for about 5 years was that no one was going to get a feel good when we killed him. She learned that indeed was fact. And I said to her, I said, how do you feel now about Tim McVeigh's death? And she said, well, she did not say that she regretted it. What she said was, I never got to tell him what he did to my family. to me and my family. And she said, I did that with Terry Nichols. Because she had written a very angry letter to Terry Nichols, calling him all kinds of names. And to her surprise, Terry Nichols responded to her letter. The second letter that she wrote to him was much less angry, and Nichols responded to that. Their correspondence now is friendly, which tells me that a tremendous amount of healing has taken place. And the mere fact that she will never be able to confront Tim McVeigh still eats at her, and she will be the first one to tell you so. So many times killing people works in the opposite as what they're supposed to.
When we last spoke back in 1998, you had said actually at the time that there had been 4 suicides of people who had been directly involved with the Oklahoma City bombing. Has that situation gotten worse since then?
There are now 7 that we know of, and there are some others that are suspected. And there was one, for example, a small plane went nosedive into the ground, and they really think that was suicide, but that's not one of the 7 that's counted. Actually, one of the 7 was a good friend of mine, and she had been in the Murrah Building, and she worked for HUD, and she had walked out of her office and walked into the hallway to get a drink of water at the water fountain. Just as she arrived at the water fountain, the bomb went off and split the flooring off a foot and a half behind her. And the 7 women that she had just left all fell to their deaths. And she struggled with survivor's guilt. And finally, in early 1999, she took an overdose, laid in a hospital in a coma for 9 days and died. And later, her husband and I and two other people, 4 of us, went to Nairobi, Kenya in July of 2000, and because of the horrible bombing they had at the U.S. Embassy there, and we met hundreds of survivors and family members of that awful bombing. And I think it helped us with our healing process, and I know it helped many of them with their healing process for us to go there and spend some... We were there for 10 days and just spend some time with them. But who knows how many suicides there have been since 9/11. We don't know those figures exactly, but they're caused by different reasons. Survivor's guilt is one of the main reasons.
I also remember you telling me last time we spoke that you get so many calls from others who have gone through a similar situation, and that in a lot of ways that kind of is part of your healing process as well, being able to talk to these other people. And it seems like they're talking to you helps them enormously.
Yes, and it actually helps both of us. And I actually met a man last night here in Seattle that has lived through the execution of his younger brother. And I meet many family members like that that have gone through the execution of a son, an uncle, a brother, and you can see their pain, and their pain is their pain really is no different. And I still meet, and after 9/11 happened, I've met several. I'm gonna guess probably 75 or 80 people from 9/11. There's a group there called Peaceful Tomorrows. And I think they have about 200 members, and they joined as a group pretty shortly after 9/11 happened, and they're all people that have had brothers, sisters, children that were killed. And what they were all about is they did not want the retaliation. A number of that group has since been to Afghanistan, met with mothers of young men that died in Afghanistan. They did not want the Iraq War to take place. They were opposed to that. And so I met quite a number of those people in New York, because I go there quite often. And that's, I think it's healing for them. I think it's healing for me. I actually met in New York in 2002, Aisha Alwafi. Aisha is the mother of Masawi, and his trial starts Monday in Virginia. And spent a couple of days with her, saw her pain, and I was able to tell her my story about my Julie, and I think that was very, very healing for the two of us. So you can meet people that have gone through tragedies on both sides, and it's really not much different.
Bud, any final words you would like to leave with our listeners?
Probably this. I'm often asked when I speak, what can I do to abolish the death penalty? And most of the time my response is this: we all know what the most important thing in real estate is, and it's three things. It's location, location, location. The most important thing in the death penalty is three things also. It's education, education, education. I have found that in traveling around, even lawmakers, I'm amazed at how many lawmakers in our various state legislatures know very little about the nuts and bolts of the death penalty, know very little about the fact that we only kill the poor people, know very little about the fact that we have 127 people that were once on our death rows that are now exonerated. There's just a lot of facts and figures that people don't know. They don't know the cost. Every time we execute someone in this country, it costs us $3.2 million. The most expensive state in the union to try someone, give them a life sentence, and keep them the 40 and a half years, as they say, the average, the most expensive state is Connecticut. And they're still less than $1 million to do that. And I think as people learn more and more about the death penalty, that they become opposed to the death penalty. And it's like everything else. It's like every other social ill in our country that we've been through in the past. The more people know about it, the more they... The desegregation, the most important thing that happened in desegregation is the march from Selma to Montgomery. And when that got on television and they saw American citizens being fire hosed and they saw dogs attacking American citizens, it captured the conscience of America when that ended up on television. And that was the last big issue that got desegregation done in this country. And when we find out about more and more people that have been executed that are innocent, then we will finally change this, and we will abolish the death penalty. And 50 years from now, we'll look back on it, and we will say, did we really used to tie people down and kill them? I won't be here to see that day, but I know that's what's going to happen.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
Thanks, Mike.
We have just been talking with Bud Welch, who lost his daughter in the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing and on the board of the National Coalition Against the Death Penalty.